It was just hours after the bombing when the news channel first told you about the possibility that surveillance cameras may have captured the explosion and the killers on tape. Our sources and sources for the LA Times describe what's actually on those tapes. The information shows some huge surprises, the biggest that it may have been John Doe number two, not Timothy McVeigh, who detonated the bomb. Brad Edwards has the latest on the investigation in this exclusive news channel report.
Our new information comes directly from a source that has seen parts of those surveillance tapes. It also comes from reports now in the Los Angeles Times. But perhaps the biggest surprise is contained in the news channel's own information. Timothy McVeigh was not the last person to leave the Ryder truck. In fact, another man sat inside the cab of the truck after McVeigh got out. We believe that man is John Doe number two, a man who, for all we know, is still on the loose, leaving open a vital question. Was it John Doe number two who actually set off the bomb, not Timothy McVeigh, as we've all been led to believe? News Channel 4 has for weeks been demanding copies of the surveillance tapes from the FBI. The federal government so far is dragging its feet. But many people in the investigation have seen the tapes, and now so has a source willing to describe to the news channel what the tapes show. The LA Times report shows there was a surveillance camera near the corner of 5th and Harvey and another near the corner of 5th and Robinson. Federal investigators recreated the time sequence leading up to the bombing by matching the video and still photos from the surveillance cameras.
Since we can't show you the tape ourselves, we're reenacting what our source says he saw on those tapes.
As witnesses told the news channel before, the tape showed the Ryder truck parked in front of the Murrah building where we now know the blast went off. As witnesses also told us, the tape showed two men sitting inside the Ryder truck. A man strongly resembling Timothy McVeigh gets out of the driver's side, steps down. He then appears to have dropped something on the step up into the truck. He bends down and appears to pick something up off the step. Then he turns and walks directly across 5th Street toward the Journal Record building. All this time, John Doe number two is still inside the Ryder truck's cab, sitting on the passenger side. Time passes. The surveillance tape is time-lapse photography. Without knowing exactly the time interval between shots, our source can't be sure how long John Doe number two sat in that cab. What was he doing all that time? Then the tape shows John Doe number two getting out of the passenger side of the Ryder truck. Again, the tape shows that a bombing witness accurately described what happened next to News Channel 4.
I was standing in the building, and I looked out the window, and I seen the Ryder's truck, and I seen a man get out of the Ryder's truck.
The tape shows John Doe number two getting out, shutting the passenger side door. He steps toward the front of the truck and is momentarily out of the frame of the surveillance camera. But shortly, he appears back in frame, walking toward the rear of the truck, still on the sidewalk in front of the Murrah building. Again, he turns east toward the front of the truck, looking toward the street. John Doe number two then walks diagonally across 5th Street toward the east, as if heading toward the YMCA or the intersection of 5th and Robinson. He again leaves the frame of the camera. Another camera shooting from another angle clearly shows the actual explosion that destroyed the federal building and killed 169 people.
In any normal trial, the footage of the defendant at the scene of the crime with the alleged murder weapon would be the centerpiece of the prosecution. But this was no ordinary trial. Not only did the FBI never produce the surveillance footage in court, they never released it at all. Despite multiple sworn affidavits showing that the tapes exist, that they show John Doe number two, and that the cameras were removed from the scene by the FBI on the day of the bombing, they have still never been shown to the public. After a years-long court case that continues to this very day, the FBI claim that they have searched their records for the tape, but they just can't find it. So why is the FBI so concerned about keeping this footage from the public? It shows two things which could completely change our understanding of what happened on April 19, 1995. The first is the possibility that the Ryder truck bomb was not the only bomb at the Murrah building that day.
The first bomb that was in the federal building did go off. It did the damage that you see right there. The second explosive was found and defused. The third explosive that was found, and they are working on right now as we speak, I understand, both the second and third explosives, if you can imagine this, were larger than the first.
That they have found a second explosive device of some kind inside this building.
Justice Department is reporting that a second explosive device has been found.
One device was deactivated. Apparently there's another device.
That in fact two different explosive devices were found in addition to the one that went off.
A second bomb was found on the east side of that building. A bomb squad is on the scene.
The medical teams downtown are unable to get into the wreckage to retrieve more of the injured because of the presence of other bombs in the area.
I just took a look down the street at the Morrow building again. I see another bomb truck going, so apparently they're going to try to get out that third bomb that's been talked about.
As retired U.S. Air Force Brigadier General Ben Pardon noted in an exhaustive report in the wake of the bombing, the evidence is conclusive that the Ryder truck bomb could not have accounted for the damage done to the Murrah building.
I went to a two-year graduate program, headquarters of Armament Engineering graduates, the first course that was ever set up. And after that, I worked at the Ballistic Research Laboratories at Aberdeen, which was 2 years of hands-on work designing, developing continuous rod warheads for the Blue Mark missile and other weapon systems. Well, the truck bomb, even though it was fairly massive, was somewhat removed from some of the structures that were damaged. It clearly had some what you call Broussant's damage, where the blast pressure was way above what you would expect to get from the truck at that distance.
Broussant's damage is that caused by an explosive whose blast wave is powerful enough to shatter and destroy the material affected. The problem with the failed columns at the Murrah building is at that distance, the air blast from an anvil bomb would have been 10 times less powerful than what was needed to dissolve the concrete and cut the rebar. Those columns, had they failed due to air blast, should have broken with sharp chunks of concrete connected by rebar, not sheared off at critical points. Broussant's damage indicates contact explosives placed directly on the beams. Even more perplexing is the total collapse of column B3, which caused the floors on the east side to pancake onto one another. The building was gutted to within feet of the other side. Column B4, closer to the truck bomb, is completely intact. Yet we are supposed to believe that a blast wave traveled through B4, leaving the sheetrock almost untouched, and completely destroyed the column farther away. And most of the front columns were destroyed when the supporting header beam failed. But the cause of failure, supposedly being air blast, should have thrown it into the building. Instead, it fell straight down and rolled towards the crater. General Parton's report was conclusive. The Murrah Federal Building was not destroyed by one sole truck bomb. The major factor in its destruction appears to have been detonation of explosives carefully placed at four critical junctures on supporting columns within the building. Many independent experts concurred with the Parton report. Sam Cohen, inventor of the neutron bomb, issued this statement. I believe that the demolition charges in the building that were placed inside at certain key concrete columns did the primary damage to the Murrah Federal Building. It would have been absolutely impossible, and against the laws of nature, for a truck full of fertilizer and oil, no matter how much was used, to bring the building down. The FBI put all their weight behind the lone bomber theory and tailored the evidence to fit that scenario. Dr. Frederick Whitehurst, a supervisor at the FBI crime lab, turned whistleblower over the Bureau's handling of the evidence in the Oklahoma City bombing.
Released a report today condemning the FBI crime lab for mishandling evidence and for slanting its analysis. The report is expected to specifically criticize the lab's handling of the Oklahoma City and World Trade Center bombing cases. It was the allegations of FBI whistleblower Frederick Whitehurst that sparked that investigation.
Forced to resign, Dr. Whitehurst testified in Terry Nichols' trial that a fellow FBI chemist had changed his findings and lied under oath after meeting with federal prosecutors. The Office of the Inspector General, or OIG, investigated Whitehurst's charges and issued a report which concluded that the FBI crime lab had improperly identified the characteristics of ANFO, the weight of the bomb, the detonation system, and even what kind of explosive was used.
But perhaps even more importantly, the missing surveillance tapes from the Murrah building threatened to reveal the identity of John Doe No. 2. And as it turns out, there is every reason to believe that the missing accomplice in the case is, exactly as McVeigh himself alleged, a government informant, agent, or operative. Documents obtained under the Freedom of Information Act over the past decade have exposed a long-classified FBI operation from the early 1990s. This operation, dubbed PATCON for Patriot Conspiracy, involved FBI infiltration of the militia movement, including the very circles that McVeigh himself, model soldier and special forces recruit, was now moving in. Attorney Jesse Trenadue has been one of the most outspoken voices about the PATCON operation and how it relates to the events in Oklahoma City.
As I pursued this over the last 16 years and lots of lawsuits and fights with the FBI, I stumbled across an operation that the FBI called PATCON, P-A-T-C-O-N. PATCON was an acronym for Patriot conspiracy. Mm-hmm. And the FBI began to distance itself from PATCON when I was probing, and they said it was just a simple operation where they were going to infiltrate some militia folks in Alabama who had stolen some night vision goggles from a military base and were selling them. But it was clear to me that PATCON was bigger than that, much, much bigger. And there were PATCON operations going on all over the country. And they referred to them as PATCON Group 1, PATCON Group 2, PATCON Group 3.
PATCON, meaning that's the FBI's name for their wide-scale, you say, investigation and infiltration of the radical right in the early, mid-1990s.
Apparently it went throughout the 90s because here last summer I received a phone call from a fellow who said, I've been seeing what's been posted on the Internet from your FOIA lawsuits with the FBI. And he said, you have all the pieces, but you just haven't put them together. And I said, what do you mean? He said, well, you just don't see the picture. And so he came to see me, and I directed him to Newsweek magazine and to some other reporters. He had been one of the top undercover operatives for the FBI and PATCON for almost 10 years. He had infiltrated some 23 groups. He started out believing it was the right thing. He wasn't, you know, so many of these informants are people who are caught in the act of committing a crime and are forced to go undercover for the FBI. He did it voluntarily because he thought these hate groups, what they described to him as hate groups, were dangerous. In hindsight, he said he looked back on it and he sees now that the agenda was to infiltrate and incite the militia movement, the right-wing Christian movement, the violence, so that the Department of Justice could crush him. He said that Ruby Ridge was a PATCON operation. He said that Waco was a PATCON operation. He believed that Oklahoma City was, but he wasn't involved in it. But he did say that other members of the PATCON group were involved in Oklahoma City.
At the center of the many threads of this operation was Elohim City, a white supremacist compound in Oklahoma whose chief of security was the enigmatic Andreas Strassmeier, son of former German Chancellor Helmut Kohl's chief of staff, and a former lieutenant in the German army with military intelligence training. And we have another angle on this as well from Carol Howe. Are you familiar with her case?
She was actually hired by the ATF to infiltrate the compound in Elohim City, which was in eastern Oklahoma, almost right on the Arkansas border. And they gave her ordnance, they gave her pipe bomb material, everything, to just find out if the people within Elohim City were, you know, capable of actually doing something, such as the Oklahoma City bombing. And come to find out, there was ATF and FBI informants that she didn't even know about. So it was really an odd mix of informants. They're not communicating with each other. Catastrophic breakdown in communication.
I gave them warnings, targets, specific targets, addresses of targets, names of targets. I know of too many people that were talking about that building, talking about Oklahoma City, talking about doing something on that date using a truck bomb.
In her report to the ATF in December, Howe reveals that Strassmeier planned to forcibly act to destroy the U.S. government with assassinations, mass shootings, and bombings.
He said he wanted to go blow up federal buildings. I mean, just point blank, that's what he said he'd like to be out there doing.
Jane Graham, an eyewitness who worked in the Murrah building, observed Strassmeier in the building the week before the bombing, going over blueprints and carrying what looked to be the components for C4 explosives and detonators.
As alleged in David Hoffman's book, The Oklahoma City Bombing and the Politics of Terror, Strassmeier first aroused suspicion that he was an undercover operative when he was caught in Texas entering a federal building at night with a key code. Did he have access to the Murrah building also?
When we interviewed Jane Graham, who was a survivor, she said that when she went to work, it was either the day before or 2 days before, I don't remember which, she parked in the basement parking, and when she got out of her car and was walking across the parking garage, she saw three guys down there wearing coveralls and placing putty on the columns and stringing wire between the putty. Later, she picks out one of the guys from photographs and says, that's him, and it was Andreas Strassmeier.
Strassmeier was there listening, going over the plans. He was listening to everything. He was what they were talking about, looking at place, pointing to things. But when they were talking, whatever they happened to finally be talking about, And when I was looking at him at that point, then he left and went over to the other side of the building so I wouldn't keep watching him. The second man that was there, who appeared to be military, he's the one that the man in charge told to put the stuff back in the car. The second man obviously was taking orders from the first man because he had wire in his hands, which I thought was telephone wire. It's that real light color, thin wire. And he also had what appeared to be gray putty.
Well, that's exactly how you string composition C4 with detcord.
Despite all of this evidence, Strassmeyer was never interviewed by the FBI as part of their Oklahoma City investigation before he had the chance to flee the country and return to Germany. This is just one of many examples of seeming foreknowledge of the attack that have since been covered up or suppressed by the FBI and the ATF.
The government has claimed that they had absolutely no prior warning, and yet we start off with the interesting little episode where two Air Force Bomb Squad guys, and these are very special Air Force Bomb Squad guys that we know were cleared to work for presidential security, VIP security, and so on. They were ordered from Kirtland Air Force Base in New Mexico to Oklahoma City on arriving on Monday the 17th of April, 2 days before the bombing. Their orders were to go to a motel and wait there until contacted by the FBI. I had become aware of this information in 1997, developed some confirming information, but the key was that in the summer of 2001, two journalists had separate conversations with one of the two individuals on this bomb squad team. He admitted he was there. When asked in separate conversations by both journalists why he was there, he responded, "You'll have to ask the FBI."
There was this fairly large truck with a trailer behind it, and it had a shield on the side of the door, and it said bomb disposal or bomb squad below it.
Authorities now claim in federal investigative reports that the huge, ominous truck with its trailer was being used by a deputy to run routine errands. Other documents obtained by 2020 show that someone called the executive secretary's office at the Justice Department in Washington and said the Morrow Building had been bombed. But this was 24 minutes before the blast. No action was apparently taken.
Yet another witness, a rescue worker, says after she talked with an agent at the bombing scene, she also suspected the ATF was warned and agents stayed away from their office that morning.
I asked him if his office was in the building, and he said yes. And I asked if there were any ATF agents that were still in the building, and he said no, we weren't here.
Witness number one approached an ATF agent nearby. He claims he asked the agent what had happened, and witness number one says this is what the agent told him.
He started getting a little bit nervous. He tried reaching somebody on a two-way radio. Couldn't get anybody, and I told him I wanted an answer right then. He said they were in debriefing. None of the agents had been in there. They had been tipped by their pagers not to come into work that day. Plain as day out of his mouth. They were tipped. Why wasn't anybody else?
Any one of these indications of foreknowledge of the blast would be incredible enough. Taken together, they provide corroboration of the thesis that the government in fact had informants in the plot and were allowing it to go ahead. But more startling by far than all of these accusations is the case of Dipole Mite. Dipole Mite was an ATF project to familiarize BATF agents with truck bomb debris patterns and to calibrate the effect of vehicular explosions on a variety of materials and structures. Beginning in 1994, the Bureau conducted a series of experiments at the White Sands Missile Range in New Mexico, blowing up vehicles with C4 and ANFO explosives and analyzing the blasts to gauge the effect of terrorist bombings on government buildings. Even more incredible, pictures emerged in 1997 of a Ryder truck parked at Camp Gruber Training Center in Oklahoma. The source of the image, who feared for his safety and requested anonymity, asserted that the images were taken in early April of 1995, just 2 weeks before the bombing. The National Guard did eventually confirm that the images were authentic and that the Ryder truck's presence at the camp was related to a weapons sensor project connected with the Defense Advanced Research Project Agency, but issued a statement insisting that this Ryder truck and the weapons project it was associated with, quote, had no association whatsoever with the tragedy at the Alfred P. Murrah Building, end quote. Could this be the other Ryder truck that witnesses reported seeing at Lake Geary several days before Timothy McVeigh and Terry Nichols arrived to construct their bomb?
The official narrative dictates that Tim McVeigh alone rented the Ryder truck in Junction City, Kansas on April 17, 2 days before the bombing. He and Terry Nichols supposedly constructed the bomb on April 18. But the bulk of eyewitness accounts assert that the Ryder truck was at Geary Lake for several days before that.
I retired April 11th, 1995, and after finishing up that morning, I decided to stop by here and fish at Geary State Lake, which is right in this general area here that I was fishing from, the pier or jetty, and I stayed here most of the afternoon fishing, of course, with no luck, and later on that afternoon, I had decided to maybe go back over this way over here to the other point back there and see if I'd have any luck. When I noticed a Ryder truck over there. I was sitting at home one day and my wife came in from work and she said that she had been stopped in a roadblock up here at Geary Lake in reference to the Oklahoma City bombing and the making of the bomb here at Geary State Lake and with a Ryder truck. And I said, well, you know, I had told you about the Ryder truck I had seen there before this. And that's how I became aware of it. And then the next thing I knew, she told the ATF and FBI, the people at the roadblock, that what I had seen. And before I knew it, my house was swarming with agents.
Multiple trucks, multiple bombs, government informants, prior warnings, PatCon, John Doe number 2, Andreas Strassmeyer. The indications of government participation and cover-up in the bombing itself continue to mount and mount, and they paint a very different picture of McVeigh than that of the lone wolf bomber that the government and media have spent 20 years asking us to believe in. But why? If there was government complicity in the plot to blow up the Murrah Building, why would this be so? What would the government stand to gain from this? Firstly, PatCon gained its objective of discrediting militias, gun rights groups, and those concerned about governmental overreach once and for all in the mind of the American public.
The United States of America. They believe that the United States government is prepared to usurp the Constitution and break down doors and confiscate guns. Am I lying to these people, Bob Fletcher and Jim Trockman?
John Trockman.
John, sorry, it says John here. You believe this?
No, not quite like that. Not the U.S. government.
Which government? The one world government?
Yes, sir.
You, the United Nations?
Yes, sir.
And you're in the woods now, and you're not, neither of you, you're not in the woods?
No, no, no.
Yeah, you're from Montana, the city of Knoxon?
Yes, sir, the little town of Knoxon.
350 people?
Maximum.
Aha, and you living in the woods?
No.
No, you're not. Is anybody in Montana?
Just their plain homes.
You're sitting next to Ray Southwell, who does, from Michigan. You gather in the woods, don't you? In Michigan?
When we train?
Yeah.
That's correct.
But you're not living there.
I don't quite understand when you say living there. I live in northern Michigan, and I have 20 acres that I live on, and there's a house there.
Right.
Secondly, an ATF that had suffered a severe backlash from its mishandling of events at Ruby Ridge and Waco could win public support and sympathy by parading as the victim of anti-government crazies. Thirdly, it provided new life to the Omnibus Counterterrorism Act of 1995, a controversial bill introduced by Joe Biden 2 months before the bombing, that would have given police broad new powers to use secret sources and secret evidence in terrorism proceedings. Widely denounced as an affront to civil liberties, the bill was languishing in committee. But all that changed on April 19, 1995. The very day after the blast at the Murrah Building, the New York Times wrote about the bill that, after the Oklahoma City bombing, there are few surer legislative bets in Washington. The legislation morphed into the Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act of 1996, and was passed the next year, with President Clinton specifically linking the bill to the bombing in his signing statement. Years later, Biden claimed that his original bill was the core of what eventually became the Patriot Act. Fourthly, the bombing also conveniently destroyed a number of documents that were proving to be problematic for the Clinton administration. Documents that had all somehow or other ended up being housed at the Murrah Building in Oklahoma City in April of 1995.
Day one, hour two of the bombing,
The most significant event that happened is when they said they found other bombs in the building. The second most significant event was that they moved everybody back and held them back. There were still people alive trapped in the building, but they came in with two trucks and backed them up to the Murrah building, and a bunch of these guys dressed in blue jackets with no letters on the back started taking boxes of files out and putting them on this truck.
We were told by a blonde female agent that there were files so serious to the government that until those files were located, there would not be any recovery effort.
If you remember the Whitewater investigation in Arkansas, all the paperwork was stored in the Murrah building. They had FBI agents over in the fields to the west of the Murrah building picking up paper almost all day long.
And it was during this time that early in the investigation that I started receiving some various phone calls. One of them was a phone call from Little Rock, Arkansas. The guy said that he was a federal agent. He was not an FBI agent. He was not ATF. But what he did say was during their investigation of the Clintons, on all the drug running that went through Mena, Arkansas, and you know Lassiter's Ranch and all of that stuff that was going on at the time during Iran-Contra, that those records, when Clinton went to Washington, were transferred from there to the Murrah building.
But what about McVeigh? What was his role in all of this? Criminal mastermind? Convenient patsy? Unwitting dupe? Or sheep-dipped operative, exactly as he claimed to be? It's at this point that most such investigations would end, with the narrator metaphorically shrugging his shoulders and suggesting that the secrets of the bombing might have gone to the grave with McVeigh himself. But this is not such a story. In fact, there are reasons to believe that McVeigh never actually went to the grave at all.
He would vacillate on this issue from time to time, but his main theme was that he was not going to be executed, that the major was going to have someone infiltrate the execution team, and that he would be given drugs that would feign the appearance of death, and he says the CIA and other people use these drugs, and that they would be taken out, and he would be brought, you know, given some type of medication that would counteract the other, and that he would be rewarded for serving his country. And, you know, it sounds a little bit far-fetched, but, I mean, I've talked to several people who witnessed the execution, including Janie Coverdale, and she doesn't know one way or another whether Tim was executed. He was covered up from toe to neck, and he couldn't see any type of IV lines or anything running into his veins. And so she clearly says that she doesn't know if he was executed or not, and she watched it. So, you know, I don't know if Tim McVeigh is dead.
McVeigh spent much of his time on death row fighting for a very unusual request: to not have an autopsy performed on his body after his execution. Autopsies are standard procedures after federal executions and would have been performed on McVeigh, but his request was granted and no autopsy was ever performed. During the execution itself, one of the eyewitnesses, Susan Carlson of WLSAM Radio, reported McVeigh, quote, appeared to be still breathing, or what appeared to be shallow breathing, even after being pronounced dead, and his eyes remained open, end quote. After the execution, prison officials admitted to using a decoy to throw the public off the trail of McVeigh, who was ostensibly transported to a local funeral home and cremated before his ashes were turned over to his attorneys. Perhaps it's appropriate, in a sick way, that we don't even have closure on this, the one part of the OKC bombing story that even the most incredulous have long believed was unquestionable. After all, the only constant in the case is that at every turn, the government has lied about what they know, withheld evidence, and otherwise kept the public in the dark about what really happened that day. Meanwhile, those brave few who have sought to shed light on these issues, or just gotten caught up in the story, have ended up with their lives transformed, their reputation shattered, and, in some cases, have lost their lives. All in maintenance of this mystery.
Anti-government
who
extremist
is
one man.
Timothy McVeigh.
An open letter to Britain's leading violent extremist, David Cameron, by Nafiz Ahmed. This open letter to the Prime Minister is published by Insurge Intelligence, a new crowd-funded investigative journalism project. Dear Prime Minister David Cameron, it is with deep disappointment that I read excerpts of your speech provided by Downing Street to the press, purporting to set out a 5-year strategy to tackle fundamentalist terrorism, which, whatever its intentions, is thoroughly misguided and destined to plunge this country, as well as the Middle East, into further chaos and misery. I'm writing this open letter to you as a matter of urgency to abide by your obligations as a human being, a British citizen, a Member of Parliament, and as our Prime Minister, to undertake proper due diligence in the formulation of Britain's foreign, counter-terrorism and security policies, based on the vast array of evidence from scientific and academic studies of foreign policy, terrorism and radicalization, rather than the influence of far-right extremist ideology and of narrow vested interest groups keen to profit from war and fear. In your speech, you say, quote, "It begins by understanding the threat we face and why we face it. What we are fighting in Islamist extremism is an ideology. It is an extreme doctrine, and like any extreme doctrine, it is subversive. At its furthest end, it seeks to destroy nation-states to invent its own barbaric realm, and it often backs violence to achieve this aim. And, like so many ideologies that have existed before, whether fascist or communist, many people, especially young people, are being drawn to it. We need to understand why this is proving so attractive. The root cause of the threat we face is the extremist ideology itself." Unquote. But this is already incoherent. You state that the threat is Islamist extremism, an ideology. You then claim that we need to understand why that ideology is so attractive, and you answer the question by claiming that the root cause of this threat is the extremist ideology itself. So, essentially, the threat is the extremist ideology, and the root cause of the extremist ideology is the extremist ideology. This is incoherent nonsense. There are always factors outside ideology that push and pull people to that ideology. No one is suggesting ideology should not be tackled. But a strategy premised primarily on tackling ideology, which is what the government has been doing already for more than a decade, has already failed. Your own government and intelligence counter-terrorism experts have been trying to convince you and your cabinets of this for years. Why don't you listen to them? Charles Farr, Director General of the Home Office's Office for Security and Counter-Terrorism, the OSCT, last month repudiated your previous ill-conceived rhetoric, implying that extremism is quietly condoned in parts of local British Muslim communities. He noted that only several hundred Britons have joined the Islamic State, ISIS, out of the 2.7 million Muslims in Britain, and that rather than insinuating that a threat is hiding amorphously amongst British Muslims, we must recognise that in reality, Muslim communities on the whole have proven quite resilient to extremism. Quote, "It's not to say that the challenges they pose are not significant. They are. But the more we overstate them, the more, frankly, we risk labelling Muslim communities as somehow intrinsically extremist, which actually, despite an unprecedented wealth of social media propaganda, they have proved not to be. So I think we need to be cautious with our metaphors and with our numbers." Unquote. Farr also repudiated your claim that the root cause is extremist ideology. Quote, "The background of broken families, lack of integration into what we might call mainstream society, some level of criminality, sometimes family conflict, are all more than normally apparent. People join terrorist organizations in this country and in others because they get something out of them beyond merely satisfaction of an ideological commitment. Sometimes it's about resolution of personal problems. Sometimes it's about certainty in an environment which has deprived them of it. Sometimes it's about excitement and esteem. We should not omit the last two factors. This is the reality in Syria and Iraq. but also many other contexts we've worked on over the past 5 or 10 years, unquote. In other words, Theresa May's top security official in your government is saying that ideology is not the main reason that people join terrorist organizations. While there is no doubt ideology plays a role in defining the nature of the terrorist group, its self-justification and actions, it is not the main driver of radicalization. Why don't you heed the words of your government's own top counterterrorism official? You go on to say, quote, "Some argue it's because of historic injustices and recent wars, because of poverty and hardship. This argument, the grievance justification, must be challenged. So, when people say it's because of the involvement in the Iraq War that people are attacking the West, we should remind them 9/11, the biggest loss of life of British citizens in a terrorist attack, happened before the Iraq War." Unquote. The thing is, Prime Minister, what you call the grievance justification was endorsed by the British government and British intelligence services just 3 weeks before the 7th of July 2005 London bombings. The Joint Terrorist Analysis Centre, JTAC, which examines intelligence from MI5, MI6, GCHQ, Scotland Yard's Anti-Terrorism Branch, the Foreign Office and so on, warned in no uncertain terms, quote, "Events in Iraq are continuing to act as motivation and a focus of a range of terrorist-related activity in the UK," unquote. In 2006, 1 year after 7/7, a report prepared for the Ministry of Defence's internal think tank, the Defence Academy, concluded, contrary to your dishonest or willfully ignorant announcements, that the Iraq War had acted as a recruit sergeant for Al-Qaeda. The MOD paper linked, and there's a lot of links in from this. Nafees Ahmed is habitually very well sourced. I haven't followed them all up. I'll point to his website from the show's webpage. The MOD paper, authored by an official linked to MI6, found, quote, "The war in Iraq has acted as a recruiting sergeant for extremists across the Muslim world. Iraq has served to radicalize an already disillusioned youth, and Al-Qaeda has given them the will, intent, purpose, and ideology to act," unquote. Nevertheless, you go on, quote, "When they say that these are wronged Muslims getting revenge on their Western wrongdoers, let's remind them, from Kosovo to Somalia, countries like Britain have stepped in to save Muslim people from massacres," unquote. Ah, Kosovo. It's convenient that your understanding of the history of British foreign policy is so selective. You omit to mention that the destabilization of the former Yugoslavia, which set in motion the ethnic conflicts across the Balkans of the 1990s, was planned and fostered by the US, Britain, and German governments. And guess what? We used Al-Qaeda fighters to finish the job. You should really know this, given your job. No, this is not a conspiracy theory. As the late Professor Sean Gervasi, an expert in Yugoslav affairs, who was an economic advisor to John F. Kennedy in the White House, explained at a conference in Prague on NATO enlargement, the West, quote, "carefully planned, prepared, and assisted the secessions which broke Yugoslavia apart, and they did almost everything in their power to expand and prolong the civil wars which began in Croatia and then continued in Bosnia-Herzegovina. They were involved behind the scenes at every stage of the crisis. Foreign intervention was designed to create precisely the conflicts which the Western powers decried, for they also conveniently served as an excuse for overt intervention once civil wars were underway. It is nonetheless true that Germany and the US were the principal agents in dismantling Yugoslavia and sowing chaos there," unquote. Dutch intelligence files exhibited in the official Dutch government inquiry into the Srebrenica massacre revealed that the Pentagon, with support from MI6, literally flew in Al-Qaeda Mujahideen into Bosnia from 1992 to 1995 in violation of the UN arms embargo. While the culpability of Serb forces in genocidal violence against Bosnian Muslims is well documented, less known is the role of these foreign Islamist militants linked to Al-Qaeda in carrying out massacres and atrocities. but perhaps you should revisit the work of Sir Alfred Sherman, top advisor to Margaret Thatcher and co-founder of the Centre for Policy Studies, who noted in 1997 that, quote, the US encouraged and facilitated the dispatch of arms to the Muslims via Iran and Eastern Europe, a fact which was denied in Washington at the time in face of overwhelming evidence. The war in Bosnia was America's war in every sense of the word. The US administration helped start it, keep it going, and prevented its early end. Indeed, all the indications are that it intends to continue the war in the near future, as soon as its Muslim protégés are fully armed and trained, unquote. The NATO operations in the Balkans were about expanding US hegemony into Eastern Europe and rolling back Russian influence, according to Sir Sherman. In 1996, MI6 had, according to American intelligence sources, begun working with Islamist extremists Omar Bakri Mohammed, Abu Hamza, and Harun Rashid Azawad to recruit British Muslims to fight in Kosovo. Among the factions Britain and the US supported as part of the Kosovo Liberation Army, the KLA, were al-Qaeda units linked to Ayman al-Zawahiri, bin Laden's deputy at the time. Ironically, the 1999 NATO bombing campaign, which you claim was perpetrated to support Muslims, in fact accelerated the violence and precipitated the ethnic cleansing of Kosovan Albanians. The OSCE inquiry found that, quote, the pattern of the expulsions and the vast increase in lootings, killings, rape, kidnappings and pillage once the NATO air war began on March the 24th, the most visible change in the events was after NATO launched its first airstrikes, unquote. Then NATO commander General Wesley Clark admitted at the time that it was, quote, entirely predictable, unquote, that Serb atrocities would intensify due to the bombing, quote, the military authorities fully anticipated the vicious approach that Milosevic would adopt, as well as the terrible efficiency with which he would carry it out, unquote. So, why bomb? Not to save Albanians, according to General Clark, who even pointed out that the NATO operation planned by, quote, the political leadership, was not designed as a means of blocking Serb ethnic cleansing. It was not designed as a means of waging war against the Serb and MUP, the internal police forces in Kosovo. Not in any way. There was never any intent to do that. That was not the idea, unquote. Saving Muslims in Kosovo from ethnic cleansing was not the idea, according to NATO's commanding general at the time. But you know better? None of this justifies wronged Muslims taking revenge against the West. The terrorists who killed and maimed on 7/7 and 9/11 and so on are not wronged Muslims. They are despicable criminals. But the despicable nature of their savagery does not erase the fact that Western wrongdoing plays a role in fueling the grievances that permit extremist ideology to fester. The funny thing is, Prime Minister, that it's not mad conspiracy theorists that disagree with you on this. It's British government counter-terrorism experts. According to a Joint Home Office and Foreign Office study, based on survey evidence, information from British intelligence sources and academic research, foreign policy grievances are critical. The report concluded, quote, it seems that a particularly strong cause of disillusionment among Muslims, including young Muslims, is a perceived double standard in the foreign policy of Western governments, and often those of Muslim governments, in particular Britain and the US. Perceived Western bias in Israel's favour over the Israel-Palestinian conflict is a key long-term grievance of the international Muslim community, which probably influences British Muslims. This perception seems to have become more acute post 9/11. The perception is that passive oppression, as demonstrated in British foreign policy, e.g. non-action on Kashmir and Chechnya, has given way to active oppression. The war on terror and Iraq and Afghanistan are all seen by a section of British Muslims as having been acts against Islam. This disillusionment may contribute to a sense of helplessness with regard to the situation of Muslims in the world, with a lack of any tangible pressure valves in order to vent frustrations, anger or dissent. Hence, this may lead to a desire for a simple Islamic solution to the perceived oppression and problems faced by the Ummah, Palestine, Iraq, Chechnya, Kashmir, and Afghanistan. Unquote. So, British intelligence, along with senior civil servants and experts in the Home Office and Foreign Office, are all basically deluded. But you and your cabinet have somehow developed a special insight missed by counterterrorism specialists in the Ministry of Defence, MI5 and MI6. You say, quote, it's groups like ISIL, Al-Qaeda and Boko Haram that are the ones murdering Muslims, unquote. While entirely true, it's false to claim that these despicable groups are the only ones murdering Muslims. The scale of death wrought by successive British and American governments in Iraq and Afghanistan alone, both before and after 9/11, is truly colossal by any standard, even taking on the lowest possible numbers. Professor Stephen Walt of Harvard University calculates very conservatively 288,000 Muslims killed by US forces compared to 10,000 Americans killed. Western violence in the Muslim world far outweighs the deaths of Westerners due to Islamist terrorism. Professor Walt, a founder of one of the core theories of international relations, structural realism, has pointed out that, quote, our real problem isn't a fictitious Muslim narrative about America's role in the region. It's mostly the actual things that we've been doing in recent years, unquote. Over the last 30 years, thus including decades before 9/11, he wrote, the US and the UK have, quote, killed nearly 30 Muslims for every American lost, unquote, a ratio that is probably much higher in reality. How much higher? A number of scientific estimates suggest that the total number of people killed in Iraq and Afghanistan by the US and British covert and overt interventions since 1990 approximates 4 million. Wherever the real figures are, between these higher and lower estimates, the upshot is that what you call the grievance justification is not, in fact, about justification at all. It's about motivation. And there can be no doubt that British government and intelligence counter-terrorism experts for the last decade largely agree that Britain's dismal foreign policy record in the Middle East, North Africa and South Asia has stoked resentment and provoked anger, thus fueling the grievances that terrorist groups use to attract disillusioned recruits. Why are you ignoring them? You condemn the narrative of a war on Islam while ignoring how our foreign policy has contributed to that narrative. If you want to change the narrative, Prime Minister, you need to acknowledge the facts of history and change your policy. You continue, quote, others might say it's because terrorists are driven to their actions by poverty, but that ignores the fact that many of these terrorists have had the full advantages of prosperous families and a Western university education, unquote. The same Home Office and Foreign Office report had also highlighted economic disadvantage as a critical factor in radicalization, not, however, in the simplistic strawman sense that you knock down, but in the more important sense that the deprivation experienced by the majority of British Muslims contributes to the formation of a general sense of identity associated with social exclusion, even for those who are not themselves excluded. Quote, Muslims are more likely than other faith groups to have no qualifications, over two-fifths have none, to be unemployed and economically inactive, and are overrepresented in deprived areas. However, this is largely associated with the disadvantage of the Pakistani and Bangladeshi communities, where the experience of Indian and Arab Muslims is much less disadvantaged. There is still low Muslim representation in mainstream institutions of influence, especially for women, e.g. in public appointments, volunteering and mainstream politics, although the Home Office Citizenship Survey 2001 suggests that low Muslim participation rates reflect largely non-faith factors such as education, economic empowerment, age and gender. Unquote. When a wider community experiences deprivation and unemployment, and 70% of British Muslims of South Asian ethnicity are in poverty, all the social science literature confirms that this has a detrimental impact on general identity formation in those communities and exacerbates a sense of exclusion. No one is saying that this alone makes a terrorist. The reality, though, is that this sense of exclusion contributes to the grievances that terrorist groups like Al-Qaeda and ISIS exploit to recruit to their cause. You also insinuate that Muslims in particular suffer disproportionately from a lack of integration within Britain, which contributes to their disloyalty to Britain and even hostility to its citizens. Quote, "For all our successes as a multiracial, multi-faith democracy, we have to confront a tragic truth that there are people born and raised in this country who don't really identify with Britain and feel little or no attachment to other people here. Indeed, there is a danger in some of our communities that you can go your whole life and have little to do with people from other faiths and backgrounds. So, when groups like ISIL seek to rally our young people to their poisonous cause, it can offer them a sense of belonging that they can lack here at home, leaving them more susceptible to radicalization and even violence against other British people to whom they feel no real allegiance." Unquote. Your contempt for the facts, Prime Minister, is astonishing. For despite the social exclusion that British Muslims suffer disproportionately, it is not British Muslims who are failing to integrate with people from other faiths and backgrounds. It's people like you. And I'm going to skip the next bit because there isn't time. You go on to suggest that those who criticise your government's flawed and misguided counter-terrorism policies are engaged in malevolent conspiracy theories. Quote, "and ideas also based on conspiracy that Jews exercise malevolent power, or that Western powers, in concert with Israel, are deliberately humiliating Muslims because they aim to destroy Islam. In this warped worldview, such conclusions are reached that 9/11 was actually inspired by Mossad to provoke the invasion of Afghanistan, that British security services knew about 7/7 but didn't do anything about it because they wanted to provoke an anti-Muslim backlash." Unquote. Why is it that in 2007, when Tony Blair dismissed the need for an independent public inquiry into 7/7, as it would undermine support for the security services, you condemned his stance and demanded a full inquiry, as only that would get to the truth? Let's cut to the chase, Prime Minister. This is not about conspiracy theories. It's about your utter contempt for the 7/7 families and survivors, who, after having suffered the worst terrorist attack in Britain since World War II, had to endure your government's backtracking of your promise to hold an independent public inquiry. It was the 7/7 families and survivors who were asking the hard questions that, before your rise to government, you disingenuously supported to win votes. Urgent questions like, why did MI5 lie by claiming it had not identified any of the 7/7 bombers prior to the attacks? Why did the government lie by pretending that no warnings whatsoever of the attacks had been received by the intelligence services, when in fact, as we now know from leaks published in the press, dozens of warnings were received? Why, despite urging an inquiry into the preventability of the attacks while hoping for votes, do you now effectively mock the 7/7 families and survivors and the lawyers and experts who supported their call for an inquiry as conspiracy theorists complicit in extremism? Prime Minister, this is disgusting behaviour and it does not represent British values. You say, quote, "the world is not conspiring against Islam, the security services aren't behind the terrorist attacks, our new prevent duty for schools is not about criminalising or spying on Muslim children," unquote. As usual, your straw men are irrelevant. Your government played a key role in creating the murdering, rapist, tyrannical scum rampaging across Iraq, Syria, under the banner of the Islamic State. In your self-serving drive to destabilize the regime of Bashar al-Assad in Syria and to roll back Iranian influence in the region on behalf of your allies in the Gulf, you and the US supported those despicable Gulf regimes in supplying arms and aid to al-Qaeda in Iraq, al-Qaeda in Syria, the Muslim Brotherhood, the Salafi jihadist groups, groups that you now conveniently claim to oppose. In 2012, the intelligence community was fully aware that the core of the rebel insurgency being supported by the West, the Gulf states, and Turkey was overrun by Al-Qaeda. We were warned that continuing this strategy would spawn a Salafist principality in eastern Syria, which would in turn trigger the eruption of an Islamic State entity across Iraq and Syria. Yet you, in alliance with the Obama administration, accelerated the strategy. You accelerated it knowing full well that British and Western Muslims were being recruited by extremists to fight in Syria, knowing full well that many of them would return to the West and pose a threat to our national security. Yet, in your noble pursuit to topple Assad the dictator, you helped other dictators support the extremists that would become ISIS. You had turned a blind eye to the radicalization of a minority of our young people here as a result. Even now, while you pontificate obscenely from your pulpit about extremism, British military intelligence officials are on the ground in Turkey and Jordan, working with the Gulf states and Turkey to supply arms and aid to coordinate operations for Al-Qaeda forces in Syria, purportedly to counter ISIS. But you'd rather we don't ask questions about that, right, Prime Minister? You'd rather we scrutinise the views of Muslim children, even when your own Parliament's inquiry into the Trojan Horse school allegations concluded that your Education Minister, Michael Gove, had severely overreached. Quote, one incident apart, no evidence of extremism or radicalisation was found by any of the inquiries in any of the schools involved. Neither was there any evidence of a sustained plot, nor of significant problems in other parts of the country. Unquote. You have claimed on NBC News to be committed to working with the US to destroy the caliphate in Iraq and Syria, but you are working with some of the most extremist, corrupt, and violent regimes in the region, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, the UAE, Turkey, Israel, supposedly to promote democracy and human rights. These are the very same regimes which, by the admission of your American colleague, Vice President Joe Biden, funded Al-Qaeda in Iraq, which became ISIS, and its rival Al-Qaeda in Syria, many of whose members went on to join ISIS. Now you're working with them to destroy the caliphate. Despite failing to investigate and shut down the same funding networks to these violent extremists that your government helped establish, your war, Prime Minister, is a farce. You, more than any other British citizen, are complicit in the rise of ISIS and the radicalization of a minority of Britons. You have helped create the militant groups, which you rightly acknowledge are murdering not just Westerners, but Muslims in Iraq, Syria, and beyond. The only people that will benefit from all of this are giant defence contractors, many of which are closely connected to your party, and which hold overbearing counter-democratic influence on your foreign policy. I don't need you to tell me to stand up for our values or to feel part of my country, thank you very much. I'm British, born and bred, and unlike you, I've been standing against violent extremists of all stripes, Muslim and Western, for much of my working life. I'm standing up for British values right now and taking this opportunity to demand that you stand up for the British values by denouncing this violent extremism that you have been perpetuating, harbouring, and allying with through your own government. I look forward to hearing from you soon. Yours sincerely, Dr. Nafees Mossadegh Ahmed. And that was Nafees Ahmed, a letter from only 5 days ago, so perhaps David Cameron's letter is in the post. Or perhaps he's still chasing up references, interviewing the staff, and even now he's about to announce an about-face, and he's going to start to be more kind to people, rather than cozying up to the guys who run the weapons industries, the terrorist researchers who've been studying how to promote fear, how best to promulgate a sense of powerlessness amongst the population. I should mention that I left out chapter and verse. He's, again, done his homework, found a lot of people contradicting themselves, people with spooky connections, deep political connections, people who are close to the weapons industry, of course, promoting this narrative of the extreme radical fundamentalist ideology. They're not criminals. Don't try and understand them. Don't think about motives. They're terrorists. And by the way, if you even hint that they might be rational human beings behaving as human beings do, you're probably one of them and you could be next. So if you want more details of that, I'll link that from this show's webpage. If you'd like to download this show or any of our 700 and something previous shows, you can do so from the MP3 archive at unwelcomeguests.net/archive. Our theme tune is by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie.